This past spring, a 40-person group of Hawaii state lawmakers, economists, and business people headed from the islands to Hong Kong and to Singapore. They were looking for answers about housing and transportation infrastructure. Given what happened in Hong Kong since then, it seems like nearly another age. Street protests in Hong Kong started against a proposed extradition treaty to China. That proposal was shelved. The protests continued and expanded, though, to a broader movement that swelled in numbers and intensity. We wanted to get some perspective on Hong Kong this morning, and we didn't have to go too far. Richard Volstek is the president of the East-West Center here in Honolulu, and before taking up that position about 2.5 years ago, was president of the American Chamber of Commerce in Hong Kong from February 2008 through December 2016. Richard, thanks for joining us this morning.
Good to be back. Thank you.
What's your sense about how dangerous the situation is right now in Hong Kong? Can this be resolved without the use of force?
Well, dangerous in a couple ways to look at it. Physically, personally dangerous. If you turn a wrong corner and you find yourself in a police tear gas barrage, that's probably dangerous. It is a bit localized, though, similar to the Umbrella Revolution. It's not just all in one locale, even though there's some central locations for the major protests, as you would imagine, around the city government offices and the liaison office government. But they popped up in Mong Kok on the other side and Kowloon side and so forth. Now this one's gone to the airport. So it could be dangerous. I mean, I think the United States has a warning out to be careful about avoiding demonstration areas. Of course, it's getting increasingly difficult to do that. So one of the main demonstration areas is the airport.
Yes.
So it makes it a bit complicated. But Hong Kong demonstrators are really, for the most part, I think, really, really disciplined. The difficulty has been, as in the Umbrella Revolution, and we saw reports of this in Hong Kong, that the triads get involved a bit too, for whatever reason. And they're the ones that instigate, I think, some of the more diligent fisticuffs, I guess, that leads to a more dangerous situation. Yeah. Common sense is the way to go, I think. Yeah. My guess, like the Umbrella Revolution, when we had to walk through on the edges of protest areas, we found the people very disciplined and easy to interact with if we had to.
And Hong Kong, historically, I mean, freedom of expression is such a basic part. And the demonstrations, you mentioned the Umbrella Revolution, even before that, in terms of the most gripping markings of the Tiananmen Square anniversaries are in Hong Kong. This is a place that is used to demonstrations, protests, freedom of expression.
Absolutely. In fact, it's not a stretch to say it's a core value for Hong Kongers.
And that idea, I think for some friends in Hong Kong, this is what is most disturbing to them, that the feel of that under threat. Do you sense that, feel it?
Well, you know, back in 1997, when Hong Kong reverted to mainland China through the one country, two systems formula, meaning that foreign affairs and so forth were handled, and foreign policy would be handled by China, otherwise as the Special Administrative Region, SAR, ran its own affairs. And there are a lot of media things. You remember for yourself, the death of Hong Kong and all that sort of thing, as major magazine cover articles and so forth. Well, that didn't happen. And then in the last 4 or 5 years, there's been more concern that 97 fears are rearing its ugly head again. And one of the things the chamber always talked about in our interactions with both the Chinese government and the Hong Kong SAR government was that the rule of law was really the transparency, freedom of speech, and so forth, ethical business and governmental practices were kind of core values for the international community, and actually our impression for the Hong Kong business community as well. So the canary in the minefield for early warning of problems was really rule of law. Hong Kong still has a court of appeals, for example, attracts the best international jurists, mainly from Britain, to come to Hong Kong to adjudicate cases. One sign we said, if they stopped coming, that would be a sign that rule of law was under threat. Well, here we see with the current activity that the big divide in Hong Kong is international Western rule of law, where no one is above the law, whereas in China it's ruled by law, which means the party's in charge, and of course the party chairman is in charge of the party. And so you use law or don't use it as you see fit for political and adjudicated by the party. It's a big difference. So the extradition law, where you could snatch somebody from Hong Kong and try them in Chinese courts, mm-hmm. is a big issue for Hong Kongers
yeah.
because it's not the same system.
You know, you mentioned the business perspective. One of the sort of the side threads of this within one of the demonstrations, one of the demonstrators was a pilot for Cathay Pacific, long-standing company, part of Swire Group. At any rate, this eventually led to pressure for senior executives to resign. What's your take on how significant that is and how you see that?
Frankly, I think that's almost more significant than the
demonstrations
from a business point of view. To have a publicly listed company have China force senior executives to resign, and then to do all these for flight attendants to have their phones confiscated and searched, and some things lifted and put on public on social media. I mean, the freedom of speech, freedom of expression, again, at the core of Hong Kong and business values. Here we got a company based in Hong Kong. It's having those restrictions, those freedoms restricted heavily. And if they can do it to Cathay Pacific, they can do it to anybody.
And clearly this message has come through, because you see then public pronouncements from Jardine Matheson, from other companies based in Hong Kong, that condemnation of violence within protests, but careful wording, I suppose, you could say.
Well, but when you're telling your employees, you don't have to tell them, they can see it for themselves, that they can't post things to their friends or they're based in Hong Kong, it's dangerous. They can't appear near a demonstration, that's
right.
dangerous. Those are really basic rights in the Hong Kong DNA that are being violated. And from the business point of view, you have basically a quick shift to working in Hong Kong is the same as working in Shanghai.
Right.
And businesses will still do that, but they'll operate very, very differently. And the international status of Hong Kong as a global financial center is going to suffer.
You know, that international comparison, because for years it would be Hong Kong and Singapore in terms of international, multinational companies, where's your Asia-Pacific base? And now that takes on a bit of a different perspective.
It does. It's still a spectrum, because you know
sure.
Singapore has controlled the press a lot too, mm-hmm. and fairly draconian approaches to protests and so on. So it's a spectrum. So each place has advantages and disadvantages. And that's one thing that businesses, depending on what they do and how they operate, are going to have to reevaluate their own operational standards and expectations, and really we have a lot of work to do with their staff and employees to make sure that people are clear about what the company concerns are in this new environment.
And meanwhile, you've got an economic environment in Hong Kong where Morgan Stanley's predicting a recession. There are a lot of the banks are looking at shrinking business, and you have sort of the pressure, not only the demonstrations, but you have a slowing Chinese economy, you have trade tensions in terms of the U.S.-China and the knock-on effects on Hong Kong. When you look at the business situation in Hong Kong, what do you see?
Well, I think, you know, businesses, in my experience when I was there running AmCham, was most of them have these kind of crisis planning mm-hmm. things on the shelf anyway. Certainly since the Umbrella Revolution, there's been some experience added to the memory banks and so forth. I'm fairly confident that the businesses will see a way. They're not going to go belly up because of a couple months of demonstrations. But there'll be operational differences for sure. And then some real evaluation on where to have operations centered, perhaps, in some certain operations, especially if control of the internet and freedom of expression. And mm-hmm. one of the big differences is the Great Firewall in China.
Right.
That's why Hong Kong is such an advantage. If that turns out to be not as free and open as it was going forward, I think that will have a major impact on the way companies operate.
One of the great factors always with China is China's self-interest. And if you look in terms of Hong Kong and relative freedom, there is sort of, again, if it's a spectrum, a tension between the self-interest of keeping that openness and versus control. How do you see that playing out from the perspective of the authorities in Beijing?
Well, this is really another, I think, an example where politics trumps economics.
Mm.
For years, I think Hong Kong has been tolerated, I suppose, because it truly is an international financial center. Even when I was still running the chamber in Hong Kong, there was a period where Shanghai was going to be the new Asia financial center. And, you know, there's a real misperception, I think, generally speaking, and especially in China, what that really means when you say we have an international financial center. It's not just having a bunch of banks.
Mm-hmm.
There's a whole environment of support for international banking and the big four and accounting firms and legal firms and other kinds of service industries, research activities, and all this that are in support of an international finance center, because international bankers speak a different language from local bankers or even regional ones, because they deal in just a much more compound, complex environment. And they are able to do that because of all these support companies and MNCs as well as SMEs, small, medium-sized enterprises that can have expertise. People speak multiple languages, travel, know the markets, do the analytics. So to move even to Shenzhen, let alone to Shanghai, which may be an expectation, I think is poorly considered. It's going to be very, very difficult for that to happen. And it won't happen anyway, because if you don't have an open, free and open communications network, and convertibility of currency, in the case of RMB, I don't see much hope for that happening. So to your question, in the next step would be, well, what's next for Hong Kong?
Mm.
I mean, we've got two out of three financial centers under threat right now, with, of course, London being Brexit-focused now. So maybe good news for New York City.
You know, even in terms of initial public offerings in Hong Kong, that those have been drying up relative to what they were. The Asian unit of Anheuser-Busch had something like a $9 billion IPO that they pulled.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think my guess is a lot of those potential investments will stay on hold until we see how things fall out from this whole episode. Whether it be shelved or deep-sixed is not a question. I think if you're responsible to your board and stakeholders, I mean, it's a good decision to kind of wait and see for a while.
Yeah.
The chances of somebody else snatching it up at this point seem probably weak. So it's a wait and see time, I think, for a lot of people in Hong Kong and outside.
We're talking this morning with Richard Volstek, the president of the East-West Center since 2017, and before that, president of the American Chamber of Commerce in Hong Kong. And also before that, president of the American Chamber of Commerce in Taipei, which is another interesting perspective to look at all of this. And how is Taiwan generally looking at, and the leadership in Taiwan, Tsai Ing-wen looking at Hong Kong?
Well, you know, the one country, two systems formula was initially promulgated by Beijing as a way to bring Hong Kong and Taiwan back to the mother country, right? It never had any sales value in Taiwan, because it's a very different. It was not a British colony. It's a very different historical background, and so that didn't carry much water to begin with. And now with what's happening in Hong Kong, it is even making it very difficult for Tsai Ing-wen's KMT opponent in the next election to say much of anything, because it's closer ties with the mainland. We see what happens in Hong Kong with closer ties.
And that showed up in the political polling.
It has. It definitely has. There's been a significant shift. So, you know, the real issue for what I'm looking historically at Taiwan, I think they have a real opportunity now with companies that are also reevaluating their operations in China because of rule changing that allows more theft of IP and also restricts their operations as far as market access, and also has new regulatory environment that really said it's not very cost effective sometimes for operations. So you look at companies that want to be near China, operating in China, but maybe have some of their operations at least outside. So Hong Kong was one of those destinations. Now Taiwan can be. I mean, it should be, actually. But it's interesting that Taiwan and the mainland have somewhat similar market access restrictions. And so the number of American and European firms, for example, in Taiwan is relatively small because of market access. Really a protected environment for a long time. I lobbied when I was there for more opening as a counterbalance to the economic connections with mainland. But it has not really, it's gotten better somewhat in the last two or three years, but not significantly. So here's a real opportunity for Taiwan to, you know, make some major moves on longstanding recommendations on market opening and start welcoming companies to set part of their operations there.
Earlier you used the word tolerance in reference to Hong Kong. Tsai Ing-wen has talked about the idea of granting amnesty to some protesters in Hong Kong. And the Beijing authorities, you know, don't like that idea. But again, in terms of the tolerance level, how do you see that as a factor?
Well, I think it's hard to know the details on the reasoning behind that. But my guess is that there is a sense of camaraderie, I guess, between what the Taiwan people are facing now. Now Hong Kongers have a chance firsthand to see some issues of the same sort. And so I think those are expressions of support. Whether it would be actually eventuate in actual, you know, results, it's hard to say at this point. But, you know, Beijing does not have a sense of humor. And so the even a hint at some things that go counter to their own narrative has kind of a knee-jerk reaction.
So watching from the United States here, how should folks in the United States, folks in Hawaii, be watching developments in Hong Kong?
Well, certainly, I think it's a harbinger of China's whole Asia orientation. You know, the Belt and Road issues and so forth. They've got a lot of positive press on investment and activities and so forth. And so here they've taken a globally renowned city and doing things that is really bad press. Now, they have done anything above, you know,
rolling in the PLA.
Haven't brought in the PLA. It would be probably the People's Armed Police, not the PLA. I mean, it's hard to say. But they're more trained for controlling riots in China, so why not in Hong Kong? But the messages that are being sent about the way Chinese operate, albeit from their perspective domestically, is difficult for, I think, the general narrative. Another problem is October 1st is the 7th anniversary of the founding of the People's Republic, and they would prefer not to have that be an unsullied celebration. And here that's only, 6 weeks away or less, actually 5 weeks away.
And that's a bit of a deadline
in a sense. And you can't just stop this day before. You've got to have time for the media to move on to other stories, I guess. So there's a kind of a deadline, it seems, in the air for some kind of activity. The biggest conundrum to me, and I worked with Carrie Lam when she was chief secretary very well. The chambers met with her on a regular basis, and we did as an American chamber. Always struck me as being a very smart politician, open, and a good decision maker. So I'm really baffled at the total intransigence on decision on not just shelving the extradition law, but just pulling it all together, which is one of the first demands made by the demonstrators. Why not do it? So you kind of wonder who's really pulling the strings there, because it's really, from my experience, is really not in line with her normal way of operation. But people change, I guess, for one reason or another.
Richard, thanks so much for coming in and sharing some thoughts this morning.
My pleasure. Always good to see you.
Richard Volstek, president of the East-West Center here in Honolulu.